Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Local Matters Health Matters. Today, we're talking about a condition that affects millions of Americans, osteoarthritis, or OA, as what some people say, the most common form of arthritis that can cause pain, stiffness, and limit mobility. Joining us today is Dr. Chris Archer, an expert in orthopedic health who's worked extensively with patients managing arthritis and other joint conditions. Chris, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first, before we jump into the topic, I would like for you to tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to work in orthopedics.
Certainly. Early on when I began my educational, when I started my education, my background was in sports medicine. So I earned a bachelor's from Valdosta State University and then became a certified athletic trainer and also obtained a certification to teach health and physical education. I went on to get a master's degree in exercise physiology from Austin Peay. And when I was at Austin Peay, I had an opportunity to work with Cooper Beasley, who was the team orthopedic surgeon there. And after shadowing Dr. Beasley, I realized that I wanted to do more than just athletic training. So I started to consider medical school, PA school, nurse practitioner school. After discussing my options with one of my nutrition professors at graduate school, she encouraged me to explore Vanderbilt University's nurse practitioner program. One of the things I found out at that time, it was like October, I guess, during that time frame, and I found out that they had a rolling application process. So if they had spots that were open, you could still apply for the next year. So I sent in my application in October, and right before Thanksgiving, pretty funny story, I got a knock on the door, and it was my neighbor, and he handed me this piece of mail from Vanderbilt and opened it up. And it was my acceptance letter.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I had to shift gears. I had to finish the program that I was at. I was in a one-year master's program at Austin Peay, so it was three semesters. But also, I'd add microbiology to that mix in order to get all my prerequisites for Vanderbilt. So I got that done. I went to Vanderbilt, completed my MSN or master's in nursing at Vanderbilt, and then later finished up my doctor's in nursing practice at Arkansas State. I spent the last I spent my entire 25 years in Cookeville, Tennessee, working as a nurse practitioner. The first 18 years was in orthopedics. I was a clinical nurse practitioner and a surgical first assistant in orthopedics with Upper Cumberland and now Tier 1. Okay. After that, over the last 6 years, I've transitioned to primary care and occupational medicine. And this is I continue to integrate my orthopedic experience with my comprehensive patient-centered care today.
Yeah. So you have an extensive background. And I see how you got to where you were. Now, your MSN from Vanderbilt, your NP, is it, are you adult, family?
Adult.
Adult. Okay. Yeah. That's what I was thinking you were, but I just wanted to make sure that I understood. So, I guess you said, you already answered my next question. I was going to say, how long have you been working with patients? But you've been here, been practicing 25 years, right? Is that what you said?
That's correct. I've been caring for patients with osteoarthritis and related joint conditions for the last 25 years. But I'm not only a provider of caring for patients with osteoarthritis, but I'm also a patient myself. I've had bilateral knee surgeries, bilateral hip surgeries. I've had my right shoulder operated on twice. I've got fairly significant arthritis of my lower back. I've had multiple epidurals and facet ablations for my back. Both knees are moderately arthritic. My right hip is moderately severe arthritis.
I mean, you're falling apart over there, Chris.
at the seams, at the seams. But despite this, I remain active. I continue to do CrossFit 5 days a week. But I generally understand what it takes to live with osteoarthritis and stay active. And I believe my personal experience with what I'm having to go through helps shape the way I take care of patients as well.
Absolutely. Well, and I think, too, that you can empathize with people. So you understand where they're coming from. You understand what the treatments look like. You understand what it feels like to have those. So I think that gives you another layer.
It does. It does. I mean, it's just like anything else. When you go to somebody that, you know, is treating you for a problem, but they've never had that problem.
Yeah.
You know, when you have somebody like me that I've had multiple injections, I've had PRP, I've basically had it all. And so I've gone through the operations, I understand what it takes to recover from those operations. And so there is a level of empathy, sympathy that's related to that that other people can't bring to the table.
And I'm sure gave you a greater appreciation for your patients too and what they're experiencing.
Most certainly does.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back a step, I guess. Let's start with the basics. For the listeners who might not be familiar, how would you describe, in simple terms, osteoarthritis?
So osteoarthritis or OA is basically wear and tear of the joint over time. Using the example of the knee joint, the femur and the tibia and the patella make up the knee joint. The ends of those bones are covered with a smooth padding called articular cartilage. And when this articular cartilage starts to wear away, mm-hmm. you start to develop arthritis. And there, you know, you can level arthritis in grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4. But when the cartilage begins to wear down, the protective layer then starts to get damaged. And initially, one of the things I tell my patient is that when you're young, your joint moves and has almost no friction. It's like ice on ice. If you take two pieces of ice and move those together, there's almost no friction whatsoever. Yeah. And once your joint becomes arthritic, the best analogy I have is like sandpaper on sandpaper. Mm-hmm. It's just rubbing and rough. And a little flex of articular cartilage will go throughout the joint, and that creates inflammation, swelling, and discomfort.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I appreciate that. That does make sense. There are different types of arthritis. So osteoarthritis, you know, how does that differ from other types? People may have heard of rheumatoid arthritis.
So osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis are both forms of arthritis, but they differ in their disease process. OA is wear and tear of a specific joint in the articular surface, and it's driven mainly by mechanics, how the joint moves and loads, and it's usually low-grade inflammation that develops over time. RA, on the other hand, is an autoimmune disease, and the autoimmune disease attacks the joint lining, which leads to significant inflammation and joint damage. RA is treated with disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, which target the immune system, and they're very different in their approach than OA, which is usually managed with exercise, weight control, medications like anti-inflammatories, mm-hmm. And injections. So,
yeah. So thinking of arthritis in age, because we always think of it only, you know, arthritis is only in the geriatric population, older adults. So when would you say, on average, are people starting to develop osteoarthritis?
It really depends. Now, if there's no injury to a specific joint, it's generally going to be later in life.
Okay.
But genetics play a huge role in this. Mm-hmm. And I've seen 40-year-olds that need knee replacements.
Yeah.
And they've had no specific injury. And then, unfortunately, they just, as I tell people, they chose the wrong parents. And their genetics have played a huge role in them developing the arthritis that they've obtained through no fault of their own.
Yeah.
And I've seen 80-year-olds with no arthritis at all.
So. Right. So if you, I know you said genetics do play a big role in that. Athletes, you know, heavy athletes that are, you know, from a young age on up, do you feel like they are more susceptible at times?
Yeah, definitely like sports like football.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of the heavy repetitive jumping and loading that's required during those sports. But you can play sports and not develop arthritis as long as you don't get injured. And the injuries that require surgery are going to be the ones that are more than likely going to develop an arthritic condition later on.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to go without injury nowadays. Now when we play sports all year round.
It's difficult. Right? Yeah, because there's no rest. Most people are playing the same sport for, like you said, 10 or 12 months now, as opposed to when I was growing up, we played baseball, we played football, we played basketball. There was always a different season. A different sport, and you were under different loads during those times as well.
Yeah, I think the same thing. So let's talk about common causes and risk factors for OA.
You know, I think we mentioned some of them already. The big risk factors, in my opinion, is prior injury to the joint. So if somebody's had an ACL or a meniscus injury, they're going to be at significant increased risk. And I've got, you know, a friend who is a high-level athlete that had an injury that required a surgery, and his knee is worn out, and he's not even 40 years old right now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, there may be a few things that can kind of mitigate that from this point on, but when you got severe bone-on-bone arthritis, there's not a whole lot you can do other than just, you know, hang with the discomfort, take the discomfort, take the dysfunction that's created by the joint, or go on for an operation that's going to require a long recovery and also probably some activity modification after the operation. The other thing is obesity.
Mm-hmm.
So the more you weigh, the more stress you put on the joint. Any kind of heavy repetitive joint loading, as we talked about, football, things of that nature, rugby would be another one, are going to kind of increase your risk. Genetics, age, And here's the one that, that I've got an explanation for, but okay. also female increases your risk.
Okay.
And I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to explain that a little
yeah,
bit. Women
please
are definitely more prone to osteoarthritis because of the combination of things. One is hormonal, mm-hmm. two is anatomic, and then you got some biomechanical factors that are associated with that. So after menopause, estrogen levels fall sharply, and the estrogen has a protective mechanism for the cartilage and the joint metabolism. When that protection decreases or goes away, the rate of cartilage wear and inflammation increases in that woman. Women also tend to have different joint alignments and biomechanics. Their hips are wider for birthing for children. Mm-hmm. Their Q angles are greater for their knees, and they also have a little bit more ligament laxity than guys yeah. do, all of which will increase stress on the joint over time. In addition, women often have a little less muscle mass than men,
mm-hmm. right.
and the lower muscle mass, the best way I explain it is for your knees, your quads are your shock absorbers for your knee joint. And when your quads are weak, the knee joint's taking more stress. When your quads are strong, then they're taking some of the stress away from the knee joint. And so if they have smaller muscle mass, you know, especially in the quadriceps, it can reduce some of the joint stability and accelerate some of the cartilage breakdown over time.
So prior injury to a joint.
I think that's the biggest. And genetics. The
yeah.
prior injury and genetics are the
okay.
two biggest risk factors.
Obesity, you mentioned.
Yes.
I mean, obviously that's common sense. The more weight on a joint, the more stress it's going to have. Age and female gender.
Correct.
Is our number one risk factors for OA. Okay. Well, more when we come back and we'll talk about some signs and symptoms and maybe do a little myth versus truth, if you're okay with that.
That sounds great.
Okay. Welcome back. If you're just now joining us, we're talking with Chris Archer about osteoarthritis, what it is, who it affects, and what you can do to keep your joints healthy. So, Chris, in our last segment, we were trying to understand osteoarthritis a little bit, and you described differences between OA and RA. We talked about risk factors and common causes. But one thing I wanted to look at, just closer to home in our community, how common is OA here in our community in Upper Cumberland?
You know, it's quite common. When I worked in orthopedics, that was a big part of my practice, was taking care of patients on a daily basis yeah. with OA. And the statistics show that about 1 in 5 in U.S. adults are diagnosed with arthritis, and that sharply increases as your age goes up.
Mm-hmm.
We see women affected more than men, we talked about. And OA is more common than RA. And if you're looking at the statistics, it's about 90 to 95% OA and about 5 to 10
yeah.
RA.
Yeah. Okay. Do you know, and you may not know this right off the top of your hand, do you know what the most common age of diagnosis is?
I don't
People
know.
Probably have it a long time before they're diagnosed, right?
And truly, yeah, I think that it truly depends on, you know, how much dysfunction they're having.
Yeah.
But I would say probably the most common age, if I recall from, you know, orthopedics, it's going to be somewhere in the roughly in the 40s to 50s.
Yeah.
It's going to kind of
yeah.
somewhere be in that age range, fifth decade, sixth decade, somewhere
yeah.
around there.
When it starts affecting your quality
exactly.
of life
yep.
is whenever people will seek treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about symptoms. What are some of the early warning signs that people should not ignore?
You know, some of the early warning signs that you see are actively related joint pain that eases with rest. If you have morning stiffness when you first get up in the morning that starts to subside after you've walked for 10 or 15 steps, that could be a sign of OA. Popping and grinding is another one, swelling after activity. As OA progresses, the patient will gradually start to lose range of motion, and they'll feel less confident in the joint as well.
Well, that's disappointing. I feel like I have the majority of those,
yeah,
Chris,
those
early warning signs. So joint pain that gets better with rest, getting up in the morning feeling stiff. I mean, I think these are common things that happen pretty early on in our age. Swelling after activity, and you said decrease as it progresses, decreased range of motion in that joint.
Yeah, and losing a little bit of confidence. You're not as confident
yeah.
as you used to be in
yeah.
that joint. So
yeah. And I think there is a difference nowadays, you know, that you if you were up on two steps, that might now, since I'm in my fourth decade, I might reconsider just jumping off of two steps versus just stepping down gently.
Yeah, no doubt. There's a lot of Instagram reels out there. You know, when you were younger, you had no problem whatsoever jumping out of the back of the pickup truck.
Right.
And now at 51, I'm not going to do that anymore.
No, I'm going to sit down or go down the ladder 100%. I'm right there with you. Okay, so why is it so important to recognize and address OA early on?
You know, early detection is key. One, because of education and learning what you have and what you have going on.
Yeah.
Exercise plays a huge role in what to do and what not to do. So strengthening muscles around the joint, as we talked about before, are kind of like the shock absorbers of that joint. When the muscles around the joint, muscles and tendon around the joint are strong, they will take away some of the stress from that joint. Avoiding pounding activities that affect the joint, weight management, a tailored pain management program, are most effective at delaying the progression of OA.
Okay. And you mentioned the exercise, and I've got that in my myth versus truth, so I'll wait till we get to there.
Yes.
But I do want to talk about that a little bit more, because I think that's a common misconception that people have when they end up with arthritis or early signs of it. So let's switch gears just a little bit. Let's do some myth versus truth. So I'm going to throw out a few common statements that I hear from patients about arthritis, and you tell us if they're myth or truth. Okay?
You got it.
Okay. So the first one, cracking your knuckles causes arthritis.
You know, unfortunately, that's a myth. Everybody, I've heard that since I was a child. You know, your mom, don't crack your knuckles, they'll become arthritic. But unfortunately, that's a myth. The studies show that there's really no higher risk of OA in the hand or the fingers with people that repetitively crack their knuckles, just people that don't.
Okay, I need my mom to hear that. She tells my kids that all the time, and I said, Mom, that's not true. She's like, hush. Okay, here's another one. Osteoarthritis is just a normal part of getting older. Everyone gets it eventually.
You know, and that's another myth. OA is common with aging, but it's not inevitable. And it's not just wear and tear, it's lifestyle rehab and the things like that that matter. And like I said before, you know, I've seen patients that are 80, 85 years old with not an iota of arthritis within them. It doesn't mean they don't have some joint pain or joint discomfort, but their bones and joints are not arthritic. So it doesn't mean that you're going to develop it, but as you get older, there is a propensity for arthritis kind of creeping up on you and getting worse as you age.
Yeah, absolutely. So how about this one? If you have arthritis, you should avoid exercise to protect your joints.
You know, that's another myth. People with arthritis, you know, people, they'll say that people with arthritis should avoid exercise. The truth is that exercise is one of the cornerstones in the first line treatments for OA.
Yeah.
There's no way for you to strengthen the muscles around the joint without exercising those muscles. Okay. So strength training, the other thing that I think is key, that one of the things that we don't do great in America is flexibility.
Okay.
So I think as people age, they'll work on strength, but they won't be mobile, and their immobility sometimes will increase their risk of fall because they're stiff, and that they teeter and they don't have the mobility like they used to.
Yeah.
So it can increase their risk of fall. So I think strength training, flexibility, aerobic exercise is good. I think low impact programs like aquatic exercise, riding the bike, are some of the best things to do. You want to do load and demand exercises on that joint. You don't want to jump. You don't want to. I tell people, you know, I tell all my patients that have arthritis, specifically the lower extremity, to avoid running, but walking is fine.
Yeah.
And I'll bring in a key, and I tell people this all the time, and most people don't understand this. The only difference between walking and running is that when you're walking, one foot is planted on the ground at all times.
Right.
And when you're running, at some point in time, both feet are in the air, so you're somewhat weightless. So there's much more demand and much more load on the joint. And I've seen people out there jogging, and they're still – it's a type of running that are quite slow, and I've seen people power walk, and they're quite fast. And so you can get as much as you need walking without the demand on your joint.
Yeah. So I think that's important. That was one thing I wanted you to address, you know, the low impact activities, you know, strength. And I'm glad that you mentioned that with flexibility and stretching, something we don't think about, but, you know, yoga, Pilates, Some of those would be great stretches.
Those are excellent, especially as you start to age, because that mobility just goes away. You can see this in the patients when they're in their sixth, seventh, eighth decade of life. They're just stiff. It's hard for them to get up and get down because of their immobility. And that's one of the things that kind of will bring them on to a hip fracture, a wrist fracture, and things like that. So anything we can do to prevent is going to help, whether it's, you know, for the joint itself or for possible fractures in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think about balance. I mean, that helps with their balance too, you know, when you're thinking of falls and stuff like that.
Most definitely. And proprioception kind of plays a role in that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's another one. So there's nothing you can do to slow down the progression of OA.
You know, that's a myth as well. There's nothing you could do to, you know, reverse OA. Once OA is there, it's there. It's not going to be reversed, but you can certainly slow down the progression of OA. And by doing that, you're going to be working on exercise, strengthening, mobility, all of those things, protecting the joint, staying away from things that might cause further injury to the joint. Those are all things that will help slow the progression down. I tell people what you want to do is put your body in the best environment so you're not causing increased damage.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so more when we come back on managing and preventing OA. Welcome back. This is Local Matters, Health Matters, and we've covered what osteoarthritis is and how to spot the warning signs. Now let's talk about managing and preventing osteoarthritis. So once someone is diagnosed, Chris, what are the first steps in managing OA?
So the first steps after diagnosis is education. So you got to have a good provider sit down and talk to you about what your problem is, what the extent of it is, and how to move forward from there. The next thing is going to be a structured exercise and mobility plan. Combined with weight management, if your BMI is elevated, you consider topical NSAIDs like Voltaren gel. Mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent for glucosamine supplementation, okay? And one of the reasons I'm a big proponent of it is after my hip surgeries about 12 years ago, I couldn't come off of anti-inflammatory. So I was either on meloxicam or naproxen. And I couldn't come off of it. If I came off of it, my joints were stiff, everything hurt. And I said, well, I'm going to try glucosamine. And I've been on glucosamine for about 8 years now. And I rarely have to take NSAIDs anymore. And so about 6 out of 10 people will get relief similar to nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories from a glucosamine supplementation without the risk that are associated with NSAIDs. Then Tylenol, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories, as well as self-management strategies. And what I mean by that is staying away from activities that bother you. I tell people all the time, I don't really give you a list of do's and don'ts, because if I tell you something not to do, but that doesn't bother you, then I've wasted your time.
Right.
So I tell the person, if something bothers you significantly, stay away from it. If it doesn't bother you, go ahead and do it, but stay away from the high impact stuff.
Okay.
And that's the way I approach talking to people about their arthritis.
And typically, do they start out with dosing Tylenol and then move to the non-steroidals? Or how do y'all, or people have already been at Tylenol probably before they're diagnosed? What do you think?
It really depends. It depends on where they've been and what they've tried. I'm always going to try to get somebody on a glucosamine supplementation. The topicals, you know, will be next. I think the topicals, you know, like Voltaren gels, if that is effective for you, there's minimal side effects from that because there's not a lot of systemic absorption from that. So on the knees, the wrist, the hands, and things like that, the topicals work quite well. And so the combination of the topicals and the glucosamine, that works great and controls your discomfort. We don't need to go anywhere else. And then you can add Tylenol. And if Tylenol is not effective, then you can go to the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories at that point.
Yeah. So the glucosamine, do you typically use that or recommend that alone? Do you do that with chondroitin? What do you
so
usually recommend?
I recommend Vitacost. One, let's talk a little bit about glucosamine. And you got to go with a reputable source. So I tell people all the time, any supplements, they're not there's no FDA regulations on them. So they don't have to give you what they say they're giving you. So you have to go with a reputable company. And so I tell people most of the times, I tell them to order from Vitacost. It's one of the least expensive. And it's a synergy. It's glucosamine, chondroitin, and MSN. The glucosamine, it really has the data behind it. The chondroitin and MSN, not as much, but it's still very helpful. And I think it works well together. And it's just as cheap as some other glucosamine supplementations out there. And I tell them to start with that. And it's going to take 3 to 4 weeks before they're going to notice a significant difference by taking the glucosamine supplementation. If they take it 6 weeks with no significant impact, at that point, they've given it a try, and then we move on to something else.
Right. And this is a capsule, right?
It's a capsule,
a
yes.
A capsule. Yes. And you mentioned the Voltaren gel, which is over-the-counter topical gel.
Yeah.
And so, which is an NSAID as well, but like you said, you're applying it topically to that specialized area that's bothering you, and a small amount gets absorbed systemically,
yeah,
but not
very
like you've taken it by mouth.
Right, right. You don't have the same. It's diclofenac is what Voltaren gel is,
yeah.
And so they have it in pill form. But the pill form of diclofenac is rough on the stomach. It can cause ulcers. It can increase blood pressure over time as well.
Yes.
And so you have to watch all those things with the patient. I don't have to worry about that with the Voltaren gel.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the gel.
Yeah.
I've used it myself. It works very well. Okay. So let's talk about weight management. So we've talked about obesity being part of the risk factors. How big of a role does that play in reducing OA symptoms, managing your weight?
So it's significant if you're overweight. So every 5 to 10% of weight loss can significantly reduce the knee and hip load and OA. For every pound that you reduce joint pressure by 4 pounds. And so every pound is a 4 pound gain for you on your joint pressure. The knee will experience roughly 3 to 4 pounds of force per every pound of body weight during walking. So losing 10 pounds will remove 30 to 40 pounds of pressure to the knee joint with every step you're taking. So that's significant over a long period of time. Because if you're walking for exercise, you know, every mile is thousands of steps. And so every time you lose 10 pounds, 30, 40 pounds, loss of pressure on the knee joint over that sustained period of time. So it's a lot less stress on the joint.
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're thinking too, when I think of OA and the impact of those joints in your lower extremity joints. So I'm thinking big ones, hips, knees, ankles. Hips or knees, most common joints to be affected by OA, would you say?
We do a lot more knee replacements than we do hip replacements, but the hips are a close second, okay?
Yeah.
I think that, some of the anatomical differences, like for me, my hip surgeries were because I had cam lesions or impingements of the hips.
Yeah.
And I was born with that. There's nothing I could do about that. Played sports and that increased it caused the labral tear that I had, but also caused arthritis of the joint. The reason why I had this surgery was hip preservation, and my right hip was killing me. That was the other reason. But hip preservation, and it's been the best operation for me. They go in there and burrow away that cam lesion. They fix the labrum that's torn. It's pretty funny. Dr. Bulkowski at Vanderbilt did the surgeries for me, and he says, I hope I give you 2 years before you need your hips replaced. And that's been 12 years ago, and my hips haven't felt any better. So,
well, good. You're going strong 12 years later. So that was very helpful, though, to talk about weight and the impact. I didn't realize what a huge impact every pound means for someone. So that's significant for your lower extremity joints. So when should someone consider medications? We've talked about some of those medications.
Yeah.
Maybe joint injections or surgery. When do those things come about?
So that's a great question. And so what I always tell my patients is you start with the least invasive thing first, and you move up from that point on. If we're going to start with medications, I always start with glucosamine first, like we talked about.
Yeah.
Topical diclofenac would be next. And then we would go to the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Like the ones that are out there right now that are going to be the safest are going to be like meloxicam and Celebrex. Those are COX-2 inhibitors.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little bit safer on the stomach. They also have a little bit less impact on blood pressure, but not dramatically than ibuprofen or Aleve. And once you do those things, if those are successful, then we stay right there. We don't worry about anything else.
Yeah.
But if you fail those, injections would be your next option. And so there are some options out there with injectables. The first option initially is more than likely going to be corticosteroid injection or a cortisone shot.
Mm-hmm.
I generally use Depomedrol for my cortisone. I think it's least effective to the joint, and I think it's one of the more effective corticosteroids out there. It's what I've used for 25 years now. So the corticosteroid injections are very helpful. And what I tell patients, as long as they're getting 3 to 4 months relief from the injections, you've had an effective injection. If you're only getting a week or two from the injection, that's all the relief you get, then we need to look at something else. That's just not effective.
Because how often should someone be getting
an
injection in their joint?
Generally speaking, if they have mild arthritis, maybe once a year, okay?
Yeah.
If they have severe arthritis, I use the analogy, you can't make chicken salad out of chicken poop. So if their knee's already ruined and it's severely arthritic and they're trying to buy themselves time before they have their knee replacement, then you can do the injection every 3 or 4 months.
Right.
You know, there's no more destruction of the joint. It's already gone. The only thing that's going to solve the problem is a knee replacement. But if they want to hold off, say they're 62 and they want to wait till they're 65, we can sometimes get them to that point by using those injections. But if the corticosteroid injections aren't helpful, the hyaluronic acid injections could be the next option.
Yeah.
They're somewhat expensive, and it's a coin toss with that, okay? And they're really a lubricant for the joint. That's going to be Supark, Symvisc, Halligan. Those are the brand names of those.
Yeah.
Orthogel is another one that's out there. And those can be effective, but those are only done every 6 months.
And those are by your orthopedic.
They're generally
provider.
At an orthopedic clinic because generally holding the injections in your hand are anywhere from $6 to $1,000.
Right.
You know, that's not injecting the product, that's just holding it in your hand. So they're quite expensive. You got to get prior authorization, usually with insurance and things like that. The other thing that's come out is PRP.
Mm-hmm.
So protein rich plasma. And as it's continued to move forward, there is a lot of good data out there to show that PRP injections, and if people don't know what PRP is when you take somebody's whole blood, you spit it down into the protein-rich plasma components which the stem cells are at, where the human growth hormones are at, and it's what's going to help regenerate that tissue. And so you spin that down, you take the protein-rich plasma, and you inject that into the tendon of the joint. And it's been shown to be effective or more effective than even the hyaluronic acid injections.
Yeah.
The only problem with PRP right now, insurance does not pay for
it.
And the injections are somewhat expensive, $650, $750, depending on where you go.
And how long do those last? Typically variable?
You know, very variable. Yeah. In the knee joint, hopefully you'll get 6 months. Some people get longer relief.
Okay.
And I tell people when I do things that are cash pay, there needs to be a cash benefit for what you've done.
Yeah.
If you're going to come back for another one, whatever the gain was needs to be worth whatever money you're spending on it.
Right. Absolutely.
So, the other thing that's out there is a peptide, BP-157. So I don't know if you've heard of BP-157.
I have not.
Yeah. So it's a synthetic peptide that's out there that really does help in the healing process. Now, it's not going to help somebody with severe OA, but it can be beneficial for somebody that has mild OA. And it's having some significant inflammatory issues with that joint because it does help with healing, inflammation, and it's another thing. It's kind of a gray market thing that's out there. People can get it, but it's kind of a gray market. But there's a lot of data out there on BP-157, and I think it does do a good job for people that are interested in that.
Okay, awesome. So lots of good options.
Yeah.
What's one piece of advice for the final question for you that you would give to someone newly diagnosed with OA, Chris?
So one piece of advice that I give somebody that's newly diagnosed, one, that OA is manageable.
Okay.
Build a simple, sustainable plan for your arthritis through education, a progressive exercise routine, and weight management strategy, if that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can add medications or procedures when necessary. Partner with a trusted clinician, whoever that is, and use the physical therapist when needed to show you what exercises are safe and what exercises are not safe for your condition.
Yep, absolutely. That's wonderful advice, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insights and knowledge and experience about osteoarthritis.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I appreciate you inviting me.